On January 14, 1962, in New York City, the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith presented Adlai Stevenson with its America's Democratic Legacy Award. On that occasion, Stevenson delivered a verbal essay on democracy in an address memorable for its brilliance, wit, and eloquence. Here is that address.
I wonder if you remember that story of essay about the average Englishman that appeared in The Economist some 25 years ago during after the famous abdication crisis was over. All of the press, the cabinet ministers, the archbishops had poured out tributes to the splendid, was the word, qualities of steadfastness, of forbearance, of dignity and wisdom displayed by the ordinary British people at that time. This flood of praise was modestly acknowledged in an essay signed by a symbolic, as I recall, Mr. Smith, who seemed somewhat dazed by it all. I feel a bond of intimate friendship with this gentleman. And then he ended by admitting, in these words, "I am driven by the weight of authority, both temporal and spiritual, to the only possible conclusion that for some reason, which I don't quite grasp myself, I am splendid." I was speaking the other day in Washington to the Foreign Service Association. I was reminded, perhaps by the presence of so many diplomats, that of a remark that Disraeli made one time that seems to me peculiarly appropriate at this moment, when a young, callow, new member of the House of Commons came to him and said, "Mr. Prime Minister, do you think I should participate actively in the debates?" And he gave him an appraising glance and said, "No, young man, I don't think you should. I think it would be better for people to wonder why you didn't talk rather than why you did." Now, we live in a time when it is necessary as never before to call attention, serious, meditative, even urgent attention to the democratic legacy of this nation of ours. For as the word legacy itself implies, our democratic principles are not an heirloom to be kept on the shelf or a magic wand to be waved without effort or a plushy patrimony to be enjoyed without work. It's the kind of inheritance which every generation must earn anew by reconquering the known wisdom of the past and by wrestling with the unknown hopes and dangers of the present. We are all brave enough to be against George III, to be against slavery, but the issues of our time are quite another matter. They could scarcely be dreamt of when this nation was in its first youth. They are fought out in theaters as wide as the world and extending even to the space beyond. And they are fought out here at home, in our public policies, our schools and churches and synagogues, at our family breakfast tables and in our secret consciences. I will not exhaust you with one more attempt to define democracy or to say what our national goal should be. Democracy itself will always defy definition, just because every citizen has a built-in right to formulate his own definition. Defining democracy is like squaring the circle. After centuries of labor, the mathematicians solved the problem by proving that it could not be solved. And if you complain that that is a paradox, I would reply that democracy's greatest strength is in its acceptance of paradox, and in the room which it allows for the unimaginable, the incommensurable, the possibilities of human nature. But today, democracy here at home and around the world is being strained and tested as we know as never before. And perhaps you may say all this talk of paradoxical strength is pretty cold comfort in the face of the raw challenge and the vaulting ambition of the new power emerging in the world. Let me, if I may, consider that for a moment. Sometimes we hear the issue argued as a simple question of efficiency. Communism, the argument runs, has singleness of purpose. It can organize its forces in line with a global strategy. It can mobilize its whole people. It can send trained agents where it will. It can divert men and resources secretly into armaments and terrorize dissenters. It takes full advantage of free debate on our side of the line, but seals off its people from our truth and feeds them whatever lies it chooses. It hangs up a curtain of secrecy while its agents help themselves to strategic information from our free and open societies. Now, with all of these disadvantages, with all of its disorderly debates and cross purposes, people inquire whether democracy is becoming a luxury that we can't any longer afford. Is it possibly true, as the communist leaders love to say, that history really is on their side? Even if you ask the question in those terms, which are the terms that they prefer, I think history since 1945 has already begun to give the answer, and the answer is no. Communism has yet to be the popular choice of one single nation anywhere on the face of the globe. In the few places where it has extended its control, whether in Czechoslovakia, North Vietnam, or Cuba, it has been in the same classic role as the scavenger of war and of ruined revolutions. And we have seen, too, that the high tide can recede. Yugoslavia ceased to be a satellite. Poland achieved a certain measure of internal autonomy. And in more than one country of Africa and Asia, communist ambassadors have been requested to go home and to take their agents with them. So even in these terms of sheer efficiency, in the struggle between two supposed world systems, the score isn't so one-sided. The promised victory of communism keeps on receding into the future. The juggernaut just doesn't jug. Either democracy is less bumbling than we fear, or communism is less efficient than it claims. But of course, this is only one part of the argument, because beneath this question of efficiency lies a greater and a deeper question. Efficiency for what? What is their purpose, and what is ours? It is small wonder that dictatorships look efficient at waging war, whether cold or hot, because a totalitarian government is in its very essence a kind of war machine. Power is the ultimate justification for all of its acts, and the extension of power is the chief article of its foreign policy. The aims of democracy are altogether different. As I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. We positively don't want power. We positively don't want a domination over others. The greatest triumph of the Marshall Plan was not, as Moscow then said, to enslave Europe, but rather to get it back on its feet and restore its independence. Our aim in the emerging nations is basically the same. We strive not for power, but for community at home and among nations, for community with all of the rich variety and mutual tolerance which it implies, is the proper environment of freedom. With such fundamentally different aims, how is it possible to compare communism and democracy in terms of efficiency? You might as well ask whether a locomotive is more efficient than a symphony orchestra. What we do say and believe in the center of our being is that our aims are more valid. Democracy takes into account the factor to which communism seems so invincibly obtuse, the unsearchable depths of the mind and the spirit of man, who will forever thwart the attempts of dogma and of ideology to predict him or to hem him in. This is the wisdom of humility, which is one of democracy's chief glories, and which the totalitarian mind, in its vain pride, cannot understand or attain. All great students and practitioners of democracy have understood it. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes was once asked by what great principle his judicial opinions were guided. And he said, "I have spent 70 years finding out that I am not God." And Pasternak's tragic Dr. Zhivago expressed the same thing in his poignant appeal to the zealot who boasted that communism would reshape life. He answered him, "Reshaping life. People who can say that have never understood a thing about life. They look on it as a lump of raw material that needs to be processed by them, to be ennobled by their touch. But life is the principle of self-renewal. It is constantly renewing and remaking and changing and transfiguring itself. It is infinitely beyond your or my obtuse theories about it." Well, not only aims, but performance too must concern us. Let us say that our worldwide aim is a community of nations which, as the United Nations Charter says, will practice tolerance and live together in peace with one another as good neighbors. Judged by that aim, our own true aim, I believe, how then is democracy doing? What are the dangers it must overcome? I think on the basis of our American experience, we can begin by disposing of certain imaginary dangers which we hear about in this country. There's the fear of racial and cultural difference. It goes a long way back. Even Thomas Jefferson, that most humane and civilized of Americans, was afraid of the melting pots. He predicted that immigrants from European monarchies would import the very political principles from which we had fled, and would then transmit them to their children. But of course, exactly the opposite happened. Certainly today, we need have no fear of cultural and racial pluralism. We have far to go, but our country has already proved beyond any possible doubt for ourselves and for all of the world that there is no barrier of race or of worship or of culture which the unflinching practice of democratic brotherhood cannot cross. There are other fears, compounded of fact and of fiction, which are too well known and too long exploded to detain us long. From the extreme right, we still hear that the income tax is socialism. Socialism is communism, and so freedom is already done for. Or we hear that the real threat is not in the truculent power of Moscow or of Peking, but in the freedom of unpopular opinion, or in any authority, be it the President or the Supreme Court, which refuses to punish error as if it were treason. Or we hear that the United Nations is a big communist plot. If you follow that line to the end, you conclude with the discovery that the worst danger of all is democracy itself. From the radical left, and sometimes from the radical pacifists, we hear other voices of doom. We have great armed forces, they say. Therefore, our freedom is doomed by a garrison state. Or we have big businesses. Therefore, democracy is being strangled by greedy monopolies. We have internal contradictions. As the ideologists love to say, labor versus capital, farms versus cities, importers versus exporters, and therefore democracy will tear itself to pieces. And if internal contradictions, as if internal contradictions were not the very fuel that makes the engine of democracy run. You know the fable of Chicken Little, who got hit on the head with an acorn and went around screaming, "The sky is falling." That's about what all of these alarms, it seems to me, are worth. What a pity it is that the nerves of even one American should be frazzled with these mythical dangers when there are so many real and deeper dangers for democracy to face in our time. Whoever reads the newspapers knows what they are. Abroad through all of the emerging world, there is the danger that the hunger for a better life will be used to bait the hooks of demagogues, to bankrupt economies before they get started, and thus to lead unsuspecting millions into communism or some other form of tyranny before they have even had a chance to find out what freedom is. Among the nations of the North Atlantic, which are the economic powerhouse of the free world, there is the danger that this great trading community, with its immense creative possibilities, will be frustrated by a vast transatlantic economic duel. There is the danger that racial prejudice and the wilder forms of tribal or national chauvinism will weaken and balkanize the peoples of Afro-Asia and even of Latin America, and cut them off from the powerful creative economies of the North Atlantic just when this partnership is most vital to their hopes. There is the danger so recently illustrated at the United Nations that the final chapters of European colonialism will be written in violence and chaos, and the fabric of international peace and law damaged beyond calculation. All these are dangers for the community of the free, and therefore they are also opportunities for the world, for the would-be burial squads of communism. We of the West must act to avert them by every means we have. One means will certainly be to evolve on a scale never yet attempted, an enduring partnership for economic and social growth between the free industrial economies and the aspiring new peoples of the world. These are the tasks of a generation, even of a century. You and I will not live to see them completed. And indeed, they will not be completed at all unless we Americans, in whose hands so much of the future rests, can learn certain other lessons in our own society and in our own habits of thought. We must remember that handsome is as handsome does. Our country has become so conspicuous that every flaw of economic or racial injustice, every debasement of quality, every blemish of bad taste, of bad manners, or shoddy self-indulgence is likely to be studied and commented on in the cruel light of world opinion. We must learn to avoid the false alternatives, which sound so good in argument and mean so little in real life. Why argue about total war and total peace when sheer common sense tells us that the first is unthinkable and the second unattainable? Why pretend to choose between reliance on armed power and reliance on the friendship and common purposes we can develop in the United Nations when it is perfectly obvious that our national security depends on both? We must apply ourselves to the long and the difficult adventure of converting the fearful and suspicious into friends and neighbors. Sometimes I think that if we Americans had been able to foresee in 1945 what an endless train of disappointments and hard decisions and bitter conflicts we would find in the United Nations that we would never have dared to join it. Perhaps there is something merciful, then, in our lack of foresight. If our national habit were one of brooding over all of the possible pitfalls ahead, there is no telling how often we might have shirked those forbiddingly difficult tasks which a great nation must tackle or perish. So Americans have tackled many a big and a stubborn job, and they have stayed with it to the end. Now history has given us, I dare say, the biggest job of all. We are destined to work for the rest of our lives, along with every nation and people who will join us, to build a community of tolerance and of peace, a house of freedom, which will be big enough, ultimately, for all mankind. The house will never be finished, for freedom itself is not a static condition, but a process and a way of life utterly unpredictable in the forms in which it may evolve. Indeed, the house is already in existence, in a most imperfect and precarious way, and its name is the United Nations. The United Nations is now in the midst of a lot of criticism at home and abroad, much of it from people who would like to restrict the benefits of the Charter to one class, to one race, to one region. But the United Nations is built for the whole world, and if it tried to satisfy all the sectional views, it would end by doing nothing and would soon become an object of contempt. The United Nations is far from being an object of contempt today. Dag Hammarskjöld used to say, if you don't like the United Nations, you don't like the world. Because the United Nations is first and foremost a reflection of the real world of men and nations, with all of their aims and virtues. But it is also something more, something very close to our democratic heritage. It is a standard. It sheds upon the real world the light of moral principles written in the Charter. That light may flicker, but it will not be extinguished. And so long as we have strength, it is up to us to cope with the stubborn evils which the light reveals. I would close with one last thought about that mysterious thing, freedom. The true genius of freedom stems, I think, not from an attitude of warlike defiance, but from an altogether different quality called loving kindness. The very origin of the word bears this out. From the beginning of recorded language, it has been related to words meaning peace and love. One of these words is friend. In ancient times, you and your family, your clan and your tribe, these friends were free. All others in your village were foreign slaves captured in war. The free man, then, is first of all the beloved, the friend, the man with whom one is at peace. And now, under our rocket-laden skies, the family which must learn to live together in peace and in love, and therefore in freedom, is the family called man, all 3 billion of him. We should not complain that the attainment of this goal is difficult, or even in any perfect sense impossible. Our magnificent gift of freedom was forged in difficulty and suffering, and the impossible was always its guiding light. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.